Greetings, and welcome to First Foundation's Wealth Management Insights webinar. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, all participants have been placed in a listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions following the presentation. If you would like to ask a question at that time, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. If at any point your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. In addition, web viewers may submit questions at any time during the presentation via the Q&A box on the webinar console. And now, I would like to turn the call over to John Hacopian.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us. We are grateful to have the opportunity to speak with you today. I would like to open the call with a few remarks, and then we'll get into the formal part of the presentation. This is no doubt an unprecedented time. Fear has gripped the financial markets. We have implemented our business continuity plan, and many of us are working remotely. With the closures and the orders to stay at home, our society has been called to do something many have never seen in their lifetimes. The economy will definitely be tested in the coming weeks and quarters. Washington is signaling it is doing what it can to provide support for the financial system, and it appears that a fiscal stimulus is on the way. Keep in mind that at least economically, the U.S. was probably in the best position going into this. Our economy was strong, inflation and interest rates were low, and sentiment was high. Our priority, and we remain committed at First Foundation to continue to manage your money and remain available as stewards of your capital should you have any questions or concerns. And I can say with certainty today that our team has not missed a beat despite the current situation and the fact that we're working remotely. We can still perform all the critical functions, and I'm so pleased at how everyone on the team has come together. To that end, we are leveraging various technologies to conduct meetings and portfolio reviews as required. We encourage all meetings to be conducted virtually during this time. With that as a roadmap, we're going to go ahead and address all that is happening. On the call today, we have Rick Keller, many of you know, chairman, founder, head economist, Drew Chan, director of portfolio strategy, and Dan Phan, our head of wealth planning. We want to provide some updates on the markets and the economy, and then we want to hear from you. We know you have many questions, and we've allotted Q&A at the end. With that, we're going to jump into it, and let's begin. Rick and I have worked together for over 30 years. I think we've been through many crises, whether it's 2008, 1999, 1997, 98, 1990. So, Rick, how should we be viewing the current crisis in light of the impact on the markets?
Thank you, John, and thank you, everybody, for joining today. you know, this is an unprecedented time in terms of the speed at which the economy and markets have unraveled here. We went from an economy that was actually doing extremely well. So looking backwards at the economic data from January and February, boy, everything was just going great. That being said, the virus kicking in, and we saw it roll globally around the world, and each day brought us worse and worse news. But the unraveling of the markets today really reflects uncertainty and reflects a premium for turning your, let's say, stock or investment vehicle into liquid cash. So if you can think of the analogy of trying to sell your house, and let's say you believe your house is worth $1 million and you put it up for sale today, but somebody, the highest bid you get is $500,000, that cost of liquidity would be 50%. And I think what we're seeing today is that liquidity cost is rather extreme. A lot of these companies are doing well. We know earnings are going to roll over, but just like a tunnel, there is light at the end of the tunnel. This will not be a permanent event. So the virus might be with us forever, but the tunnel might be long, but it doesn't go on forever. So I think right now some of the best guess is that maybe the virus peaks and we get a downturn in the economy beginning here in March, and it rolls forward. Certainly the second quarter right now looks like it's going to be the worst quarter. We've seen estimates that economic growth could decline more than 3% at this point. I actually think it could be every bit of that because of the totality of just everybody staying at home and not spending their money. But there is light at the end of this tunnel, and I really believe that by the end of the year in the fourth quarter, we certainly should be coming out of this thing. I would like to add, this was a double whammy for us because the U.S. does have a large petroleum engine economy, and states like Texas, Oklahoma, and Colorado, Pennsylvania rely on oil drilling. And here we had a price war with Saudi Arabia and Russia getting in a war. And today with oil prices down now around $22 a barrel, that's an incredible price. But with that will come virtual bankruptcy for most of the drilling type companies, and we call it upstream at the oil field level. And a lot of those are going to be shut in. So they stated they wanted to put the American frackers out of business, and it looks like they're going to achieve that. So that was a double shock for us.
So, Rick, it sounds like you see maybe the second quarter, the economy getting hit potentially the worst, but then it sounds like by maybe late third quarter, fourth quarter, you see a pretty decent rebound.
Yes, because I think, you know, if you think about slowing down the virus, not eliminating the virus, but the steps we are taking are the tough medicine that it takes to really get to the other side of this virus. So if we can control the hospitalizations at a manageable level and allow people to stay home, separate themselves, and not get the virus, at least initially, because eventually, a large segment of the population will get it. But it also allows time for a vaccine to come out. And although vaccine may not be till next year, at least if we can flatten out the peak of this, it should be manageable for hospitalizations and allow the economy to come back to some normalcy, probably, I would say, late in the second quarter or late in the third quarter, and possibly the fourth quarter should be a turnaround.
Okay, and it definitely feels like we're sort of at the worst point of the crisis right now, because we're still waiting. There's still the uncertainty out there. We're still waiting for some of the fiscal stimulus. And if you recall, in 2008, the market bottomed once the government put in place the TARP program and replenished the banking industry. And I think that's one of the issues still out there is, what's the stimulus program going to look like? When is it going to get approved? We keep on hearing that Congress is about to sign off on it. But one of the things that has happened, rather quickly, and I'll go to Drew with this, is the Fed cut interest rates rather dramatically And so, Drew, maybe touch on that a little. Why did the Fed take such a dramatic action in some of the initiatives it put in place? And they did it, I think, much faster than back in 2008.
Absolutely, John. The Fed basically shot a bazooka across the, shot across the bow in terms of they did not want to see a 2008-2009 crisis again. If you think back to that, that really was a credit crisis. And really, when we're looking over the edge of the cliff, we didn't know if the banking system as we knew it was going to survive. Was the creditor that I'm working with actually going to be in business tomorrow? So by cutting rates to zero, basically instituting quantitative easing to the tune of about $700 billion, and doing some other things in terms of, offering discount window loans to banks for longer to allow them to access capital. Establishing two special purpose vehicles to really facilitate flow, one to the tune of $1 trillion, to provide access and liquidity and capital to financial institutions. So basically, what they're saying is we're drawing the line. We're not going to allow a credit crisis to occur in 2008, 2009, particularly as what Rick mentioned. We almost are taking a double whammy at this point with the coronavirus, along with the energy meltdown, is that we saw in 2015 and 2016. When the energy sector does have some hiccups, that can spread as contagion through the credit markets. So who owns those loans tends to be banks, private investors, and if those kind of go to zero, then obviously there's a credit crunch there as well. So the Fed has definitely gotten ahead of the curve. I think initially the markets were upset. They really wanted more monetary policy to be kicked in right away. But in this case, the Fed just was being very proactive. And really drew the line in the sand and said, we're going to do whatever we can. Now, they haven't shot all their bullets. Obviously, they could do a few additional things in terms of expanding quantitative easing further. They could go to Congress and ask to say, hey, can we actually buy other assets? You think about Japan. Japan's actually allowed negative interest rates as well as purchasing of assets such as equities on their balance sheet. So we're not there yet, but there's definitely still some bullets in the chamber.
Rick, do you have anything to add to that on, from the Fed?
I think because you're well aware we have a bank and the steps that the Federal Reserve, as Drew mentioned, have really been substantial in terms of backstopping bank liquidity. So as major companies withdraw on these credit lines, that the bank has sufficient liquidity to meet those withdrawal needs. The Federal Reserve also announced that they're going to set up a $1 trillion special purpose entity to help backstop some of the credit markets in terms of liquidity. So, as John and Drew were mentioning, the Fed was much quicker this time. So after Lehman went under, it took 3 months for the bank, for the Federal Reserve to go to zero interest rates. Boy, they did it quickly. Remember, this was a Sunday afternoon. After they had previously done the 50 basis point cut, so they took Fed funds all the way down. But for banks, in terms of the worst case scenario, I think this really helps the banks meet their needs and be able to work with those creditors that will need help through this. So, for instance, if some poor restaurant owes the bank some money and owes their landlord some money. If the banks have the approval of the Federal Reserve and the bank regulators, they can work and restructure that loan and defer current payments 1, 2, 3 months down the road and allow that business owner to get back on their feet. But the big thing is workers having cash. So, remember in previous recessions, going back pre-08, the unemployment insurance we have today, the healthcare insurance we have, the sick pay we offer, the proposed stimulus to give people cash in their pockets, these all really lessen the worst case scenario because a lot of these people are going to get laid off. They're going to have resources that weren't available even in 2008, and they should have sufficient funds that help them get through this. And I talked to a landlord person yesterday, and they said they just work with their renters. They don't foreclose on them. They don't kick them out. They work with them. And I think we're going to see that this time, that this affected everybody, and the banks will work with those people as well, so the banks won't be taking those loan losses.
What about to both of you guys? So we've seen the monetary side of things. What have you been hearing from the fiscal side? Because I think we need both pieces to probably minimize the worst case scenario, because we keep on hearing from clients, have we hit the bottom? Have we hit the bottom? And in 2008, the fiscal stimulus sort of triggered that, the bottoming of the market back then. So to both of you guys, maybe talk a little bit about what we're hearing on the fiscal side to shore up sort of the worst case scenario.
Go
ahead, Rick.
You can take it.
Go ahead, Drew. We'll start with you, and then we'll come to Rick.
I mean, I think if you're watching the way the markets are trading, even today, everyone's anticipating some kind of fiscal policy. You've heard leaked out, you know, three or four phases. You know, so far, the phases that have been expanded are really for, you know, free and expanded virus testing, you know, a national emergency budget, about $50 billion. But we're looking for kind of those, you know, I hate to use the term helicopter money, but checks out to Main Street to support people through these times. And, you know, obviously the political ramifications run deep. Both sides kind of want to get their pet projects in. And the market has been kind of punishing investors for the time being. You know, there was a rumor that the deal was partially set up over the weekend. Market sold down on Monday when we didn't receive it. Today, there's supposed to be another vote, was the rumor. Market's selling down, as we haven't heard it yet. But I think, to John's point, I think once something does occur, that might help stabilize, you know, and firm up the bottom.
Rick, any comments?
The fiscal side is spending by the federal government. So when you think about the $700 to $1 trillion that they're talking about unleashing, that should offset, you know, a lot, not all, but a lot of the lack of spending that will go on because of people staying home and not taking trips as much. But, you know, there needs to be the side to support these businesses, everything from Boeing to the airlines to the hotel operators, and as well as these small businesses. So it seems like the small business package and the large business package are going to come out of this budget proposal, because they're talking about $1 trillion, and that really should help. So keep in mind, very few, if we shut down all businesses for, let's say, a month, almost all businesses can survive 1 month. Most businesses cannot survive 3 months or 6 months. So by shutting down now, as most businesses are for the next 30 days, it should really slow the spread of this virus and really give some time to, you know, get back on the feet. So I'm really hoping that this is short-lived. So, like I say, if you know, sometime here in the third quarter, we should know. You know, if Disneyland announces that they're opening back up the parks, that will be a very good sign. So,
thanks,
Rick. I think you make a great point on that. You know, the world right now is kind of looking at what models have worked so far in terms of containment, and China, you know, shut down their economy basically for a month and has been slowly reigniting that engine. In some cases, back to 70-80%, you know, before, you know, January. I think the worst case scenario is if we continue to see containment not be successful in the large European sector, as well as domestically. You know, I think that's what the markets are pricing in right now, is that we're unable to do that.
Thanks, Drew.
I think it's interesting.
Go ahead, Rick. Finish your comments.
So it's interesting, the calls I'm getting for clients. You know, everybody's concerned, but I probably have as many calling saying, should I put more money in the market to take advantage of this buying opportunity? Because as Bill Miller said earlier today, that this is a very rare buying opportunity that we haven't seen since 2008. And the prior one may have been in 1987 and so forth. So these couple times in our lifetimes where prices really get cheap, this is probably one of those opportunities to pick up blue chip companies at reasonable price, because this will not last a year. It will not last 2 years. It's got to be a number. How many months or how many quarters does this last? Because like going through that tunnel, there's light at the end of the tunnel. We just don't know how long the tunnel is just yet. So I want people to really think about the longer term, because if we think of, you know, a 5-year period or 3-year period, this is way, that would be way beyond this. So outcome. So,
well, it's a good point, Rick. Maybe you could touch on, in 1987, the market dropped, you know, 25%, but by the end of the year, it was down a fraction of that. And so, yeah. I think we sort of feel the same way here, that if we could get through this sort of bridge of the next, whether it's 90 days or, you know, 100 days, we all feel comfortable that by the fourth quarter or a year from now, things should be a lot, prices should be a lot higher than where they're at today. It's really the next, 30, 60, or 90 days. And maybe, Rick, if you have a comment.
I did want to interrupt. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, go ahead with your comments. I'm going to switch over to Drew with the next question.
Well, I think, as I said before, the economy was on such strong footing that the balance sheets of individuals and businesses were really in good shape, and corporate profitability, individuals had low debt service payments for many years. And so when we look at it, both individuals and business balance sheets, everybody was in pretty good financial shape. So, and as we know, there are certain segments, for instance, the restaurant industry, they're going to be particularly hard hit. But I think this, if we can get beyond this 30-day period, I think there's enough firms and individuals in good enough shape that things should go back to normal when we come out the other end.
Drew, we've had unprecedented daily volatility. I remember in 2008, the market was swinging on a daily basis, but nothing like we've seen here in the last couple weeks. We oftentimes talk about the pendulum swinging from one direction to the next, and the market was hitting highs back in early February, and maybe that was the point of maximum optimism. But now we've swung way into the other direction. A lot of fear, a lot of pessimism. What changes are we making to our investment outlook? And what? And maybe talk about the volatility and talk about some of the things we're doing right now.
Sure. Absolutely. 4 weeks ago, if we had this call, we talking about, the new record highs that the domestic equity markets have hit, and that's how fast that pendulum has swung. Basically, record highs to kind of, pricing in that the world is going to be shut down for 12 to 18 months, and companies, in many cases, going bankrupt and not surviving. To Rick's point, looking through to the light at the end of the tunnel and getting to the other side, that's what the market is pricing in right now, to see, is it going to be 3 months, 6 months? Is it going to be 18 months? And it seems right now it is that latter. So we normally would see 2 to 3%, market swings. On average, we see the S&P 500 move about plus or minus 2% about 10 times a year. Just March alone, we've only seen one day below that. So that tells you how volatile it is. And I think structurally the markets are very different than before, even just 3 years ago, let alone 11 years ago since the Great Financial Recession. A big piece of that is technology adding to that volatility. The fact that we can all pick up our cell phones and trade right now on a moment's notice of news. and get our trades pushed through at zero cost commissions. That flow has definitely amplified the up and comings of ETFs, passive strategies, a lot of investors utilizing that as a form to get broad exposure buying that entire basket. And then probably the biggest piece that people aren't aware of is that, you know, something about 80% of cash trades are actually executed through algorithms and computers. So think of high-frequency trading as well without any human input. So a lot of volatility is being amplified at this point, you know, historically 2 to 3%. And now it seems, you know, today anywhere between 6 to 10%, just this week alone. But we do think, you know, long-term investors, you know, will be rewarded. We've always seen earnings is really over a long cycle is what really drives stock valuations. And that's one of the reasons why when we're thinking about portfolio construction is that for our more aggressive risk profiles, we are starting to add back into equities, particularly domestic large cap equities. You know, as Rick mentioned, strong balance sheets, strong cash flows, those that are able to weather through a lot of this volatility that are coming out at discounts. We've recently moved to neutral from overweight in emerging markets. It's not that we don't like it, but just in terms of we feel there's a lot of great domestic companies here that are basically in the bargain basket that we like to fish in. And then more importantly, is an idea that we've been talking about ever since rates have hit, you know, historical lows, is to try to find long duration assets. You know, the rally within treasuries has been pretty tremendous. You know, just 2 weeks ago, the 30-year treasury was less 1%. Now it's back above 1.6. But we still think even at 1.6 locking up your money for a long period of time, the risk return profile, pretty sure earnings growth, dividends, cash flow, and appreciation through equities might actually provide a better return just even in the next 5 years. So really here right now we're reassessing portfolios, reassessing risk, and trying to figure out, you know, when's the right time to start nibbling across that risk spectrum.
Rick, do you have anything to add on the investment outlook from your perspective?
Yeah, I think the
you talked about this being one of the better buying opportunities of the last 30 years.
Yeah, that's I believe that this will turn out to be just a great buying opportunity because I know in the last 3 days just getting set up, I had to pay Microsoft $600 to get my computer systems up to speed here with all their new programs here. So a lot of these blue chip companies will come back, and I think China is a good example where we've seen their economy coming back, and we'll start to see things come in the ports. But right now, because these people might be importing the virus, we have to be careful on how we handle these things. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they cut domestic travel, but these prices that we look at today reflect an economy that would be in a terrible condition for years into the future, and that's just not going to be the case. So this should be short-lived, and I say short-lived, maybe it's a 2020 event, but in 2021, I think things will start ramping back up. The federal deficit's going to balloon out. That will be something that will have to be dealt with in the future, but the current interest rates on a 10-year treasury, they're still near their all-time lows. Today we're up to 1.2%. So I think that gives a good backdrop. If 10-year treasuries were at 5% where they were in the early 2000 decade, that would be an entirely different scenario. But a lot of these companies that have borrowed lots of money, their interest rates are at all-time lows, so their debt service is actually pretty good. So I think we're going to hold up better than the markets are pricing in right now, that's for sure. So,
well, before we open it up for questions, one of the questions that comes to that's usually asked many times is rebalancing. Obviously, we like to rebalance portfolios. I've oftentimes said buying low is usually one of the hardest things to do because buying low usually means you're buying in the face of a lot of bad news. And that was the case in 2008. That was the case in 87, 97, 98. And all those times, you know, and when you were in the moment, they felt like they were really dire, but we knew that there was light sort of at the end of the tunnel. Anyways, one of the questions we get is for an equity allocation, you know, when we're rebalancing, as Drew said, we're trying to focus a little more on the U.S. versus international because we think the U.S. has some of the best companies. One of the questions we had from a client who shot us an email, are there any industries which you favor for rebalancing? Drew, you mentioned technology as being a big part of the economy. I think first and foremost, we like to rebalance based on the asset classes, but within those asset classes, I think we'd probably have a slight tilt towards technology because only one, because they have great balance sheets. Most of the U.S. tech companies, as Rick had mentioned, have very little debt, sitting on tons of cash. I think the biggest thing for us in terms of individual companies is making sure the balance sheets are strong and that they're going to get to the other side, sort of this bridge to get to the other side, because we know it's going to be difficult in the next 30 to 90 days, and those companies with a lot of debt are going to have a tough time making it to the other side. Anything to add on the rebalancing, Drew?
Yeah, I think, you know, just taking a balanced approach, we're value investors at heart. You know, I love to buy things on a discount, but something like a sector of, you know, such as energy, which has been completely washed out, it's kind of tough to assess that. You know, I'm not sure how many energy companies will survive, given if oil stays at 20%. I mean, today, another record day, West Texas Intermediate crude is at 20 bucks. Not a lot of firms can make money at that price. So if that case continues to sustain, you know, the energy sector is probably going to be a washout. You know, I think to your point too, John, you know, this is the new economy. I think the 2010s were representative of that, and very reflective on volatile days. You'd see some of these large tech companies actually hold their value a little bit better in terms of that's the direction that kind of everyone and every business is moving towards. 5G, moving, you know, online, using, you know, media and multimedia to converse globally without having to do it face-to-face. Things are cheap right now, but we definitely, you know, when you think about rebalancing, first and foremost is looking, do you have enough equities? Do you have enough fixed income? Do you have enough cash? And then kind of going to that secondary step and kind of figure out within there what to purchase.
And then, you know, maybe lastly, before I turn it over, on the fixed income side, we're trying to stay high quality there. I know some of the yields have blown up, but on the high yield side, and I remember in 2008, the high yield bonds dropped as low as 60 cents on the dollar. We're not ready to do anything on the high yield side. I think if we're going to add any risk, we'd rather add it to domestic equities right now. And so for the most part on the fixed, what's worked well on the fixed income side is, as Rick said, treasuries have held up and mortgage-backed securities have held up. Corporate bonds, they've been pretty choppy here because of it's difficult to tell who's going to be the winners and the losers. So we're trying to stay as high quality as possible. And if prices continue to decline on the fixed income side, we'll maybe add risk. But right now we're staying very high quality. With that, I think we're going to go ahead and open it up for some questions. So, operator, please put through the first question.
The floor is now opened for questions. If you'd like to ask a question during this time, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from the line of Marshall Glick.
Hi, Marshall.
Hi. Thank you for your presentation. The concern might be that we have is that perhaps we should sell some of our securities to have liquidity. If the market continues to go down substantially, at least we'll have some cash to live on. what's your view of that?
Rick, do you want to take that?
Yeah, you know, keep in mind, you know, the bond market, although it's down, it's nothing like the equity market. So, and we may have cash, treasuries, and bond funds, and so whereas equities could be down, you know, let's say 25%, bonds could be down 3 to 5, and some, but they are, you know, everything's being repriced daily as we speak, but there is a lot of liquidity there. But like I said, there's such an extreme cost today to turn stock investments into cash. It's rather extreme, and that should dissipate over time because prices will ultimately come back. So even though corporate profits decline in the second and third quarters here, we will see a rebound. And right now, almost most companies we own, their yield exceeds that on the bonds anyway. So if we take one of our companies and compare it to the same company's bonds, oftentimes, because most of them are investment grade, the company stock yields more than the company's bonds. So in terms of cash flow is going to be okay. The thing is, we know that most people cannot survive on a 10-year treasury at 1.2%. So, asset allocation and liquidity are really long-term decisions, and most people aren't going to run out and buy an extra house right now or car. So if you need the money, that's one thing. But this is not the market to, convert a lot of your investments to cash. I think the penalty is too high.
Your next question comes from the line of Carrie Sarnoff.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I have a quick question. Somebody touched upon this earlier, and we're talking about government intervention. Has anybody heard of anything happening like they've done in Japan, where they allow the government to get into the equity market, or indeed to pick up some of these high yield corporate bonds, get into the at least backstopping that stuff? Because if they did buy it, the reality is, if you guys are right, and I think you are right, 6 months down the road, 2 years down the road, whoever owns those stocks or bonds are going to do very well, and that might indeed be the government. Or is that a possibility?
Well,
I don't think
go
it's
ahead,
a
Drew.
Possibility.
Rick?
Sorry.
Rick, go ahead, Rick.
Sorry.
Drew, I know, Drew, you touched on it too, so both of you guys could answer that one.
Yeah, I think the government just announced that special purpose entity set up by the Fed. The Congress has to approve it, but it was up to $1 trillion. But they were exclusively going to buy short-term commercial paper issued by corporations. So if a corporation, for instance, needed $300 million, they don't necessarily go to Bank of America and say, can I get $300 million? They would issue short-term commercial paper due in 1, 2, and 3 months and raise that $300 million. That is what the government said. They will buy up to $1 trillion of that. I don't expect anything as it relates to longer-term bonds, at least not yet, without a material decline in the economic growth that's beyond current expectations. And I don't think they would touch equities here. So, but I think right now they're going to leave it to these short-term money market instruments issued by corporations.
Drew, you have anything to add to that?
No, I agree with Rick. The people that are buying, the countries that are buying their own equities, is Japan, for example, and they've been stuck in a loss 2 decades trying to re-stimulate their economy. So I don't think we're there yet. Those are obviously the extreme breaking place of emergency. We've already instituted quite a bit on the monetary side. Just to echo everyone's comments, we're really just looking at the fiscal side to see how much help they can help. Just today, the FHFA announced that they were telling Fannie and Freddie to, postpone evictions and foreclosures for up to 60 days. I mean, those are the things that obviously helps Main Street significantly. And I think that's the crux that we're at right now is people are marking down that Wall Street, you know, may go bankrupt and what the ramifications for Main Street. And so I think the pieces of the puzzle right now for the fiscal policy and everyone's kind of really hyper-focused on is how do we help those hourly workers, the minimum wage workers. That's where the focus really is right now.
One of the things that could happen is, just like in 2008, which was hugely profitable for the government, they took equity positions in most of the banks, and at the end that turned to be an extremely profitable investment for them. And so when you talk about airlines and some of the other industries that are getting hit particularly hard, if the government provides a backstop, they may end up getting equity interest in airlines and Boeing and some of these companies where they would benefit from some of the recovery. So that could happen. But as far as going into the open market and purchasing equities, I think it's probably on their list, but it's pretty far down the list. I think the more likely scenario is they provide the backstop, and in return, they get some kind of equity interest in some of these companies.
But keep in mind, if there is an equity interest taken by the government, it dilutes other shareholders,
correct,
and it will be a big loss for existing equity investors because it'll dilute the number of shares outstanding by a substantial amount.
Yeah. Let's go to the next question.
Your next question comes from George Skrupak.
Hey, George.
Hi. Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good morning.
I appreciated actually the overall picture and the different angles that you looked at the market. I have a simple question. From your perspective, who do you think is winning from all these market wins? Obviously, a lot of money has been lost. Somebody's making it that money. So who do you think are the people that are winning?
Drew or Rick?
Yeah.
I'll give you guys a tough one here. Who do you think is winning from the drop in the market other than the bears who have been on who've taken pain for the last 8 years with this straight-up bull market?
I haven't heard of a lot of people coming out positive on this drop. It was so fast and furious that it would be hard for someone to profit from this one.
Yeah, I'm
true.
In agreement.
Yeah,
you know, the only, like you said, the only people that have been right were those perma bears that had been holding cash or short the markets over the last 10 years. Very few winners in this case. It's a different environment.
Yeah, I think. In 2008, it was much more obvious because, you know, we know it was obvious that there was a housing bubble, and it went on for a number of years before the thing unraveled. This one, as my colleague said, has happened so fast that I haven't seen many people that you know, were on the other side. Remember, we hit a new high about 4 weeks ago, so the market was hitting new highs, and then it just pivoted and went the other way in such a fast direction that so far it's difficult to see how there's many people that have benefited from this, other than the people, as Drew said, that have been sitting on the sidelines for 7 or 8 years while this market's gone straight up, waiting for this sort of event to happen. And even they couldn't have anticipated quite what happened. But let's go to the next question.
Your next question comes from Gary Rifkin.
Yes.
Hey, Gary.
Hi there. I'm inquiring, the government has indicated that they will help tenants, landlords, small landlords, banks that nobody will not survive, that they will help. What does a landlord who recently may have purchased a property with a loan with a 1.15 debt service ratio, which means he's got very little room between expenses and debt service, and is April 1 comes and tenants, half of the tenants say, I can't pay, I'm not employed, or I don't have the money. And tenants do talk, which means even the tenants that may be employed will join the ones who are not employed, and that will create the potential of a landlord being in default if he can't pay the mortgage. What do you suggest landlords should be doing to try and help people that really need it, but not be put in a position where over half default on payment, and so the government or the local authorities have said no evictions, and I'm all for being very good, trying to help, but I'm asking what and where do you go when it looks like you may go down simply because even if the government says they're going to help, by the time they help, you're months behind.
Rick, I'm going to hand that one off to you, but before you answer the question, I just want to let the folks on the call know that we're going to stay a little longer beyond the 1 o'clock cutoff to answer more questions. So with that, Rick, do you want to take that question?
It's important to get out in front of that and let your bank or whoever's holding that mortgage to let them know as soon as you can that you may need relief or you may have problems. So the thing that I'd say, so 1.15 debt service coverage is really low. So I would be concerned, did you or somebody overpay for that to begin with? Because that is a really low debt service coverage, or maybe the loan to value is really high. But it's important to get out in front of it and let the bank know ahead of time, so so they know and anticipate, and you could work with them to see if you could restructure that loan. So, as I said in my comments earlier, maybe some banks would be willing to restructure the loan so there are no payments due for the next 60 days or 90 days, and be able to add that to your loan principal at the other end without declaring the loan in default. And so being proactive with the tenants, being proactive with the bank, there should be some solution, because banks do not want to foreclose on your apartment building with a bunch of renters that have all the issues you just outlined. So it's in everybody's best interest that open dialogue and solution on the table early.
Yeah, and the only thing I'd add is, we don't want this situation to turn into a financial crisis, because, banks are going to be holding a lot of bad loans, so there's going to have to be some kind of solution on that front too, because the last thing we want is these companies shut down, they can't make their payments, and all of a sudden banks are holding the bad debt. So I think this is all such a fluid situation that I think something's going to happen on that front that gives some relief to banks, as Rick said, to work with borrowers and then ultimately their end clients. Let's go to the next question.
Our next question comes from Victoria Collins.
Hey, Victoria.
Hi.
Hi, Victoria.
Hi, it's David. I'd like to address this to Drew. And by the way, thanks for having this call. When you look at the economy of Russia and you look at the spat going on between Saudi Arabia and Russia, when that settles, it would have a favorable impact on the market, I expect. But what kind of an impact will this have on the Russian economy, and why would they choose to do this when the Russian economy is so delicate as it stands now?
Good question. Why now? A lot of different theories behind that. I think, you know, partially it is the fact that the United States energy sector over the last decade went from a net importer to a net exporter, and doesn't play nice with the rest of the oil complex in terms of OPEC. You know, Russia is a large oil producer and has historically partnered with OPEC in trying to set production targets. U.S. shale and fracking has definitely gained market share. And I think to this point, they're trying to shut down a competitor. Why would they do it when their economy is so frail and fragile? Is, you know, Putin basically has extended himself out without 2 decades, basically. So in effect, there's no checks and balances in that space. He's basically dictator for life. And he's trying to play the long game of shutting down a competitor. You know, that's how I kind of look at it, why they're doing this now. Because clearly the world doesn't need an oil price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia. But really the crosshairs is the U.S. sector.
And it's can not, I add to that?
Go ahead, Rick.
Sure. Saudi Arabia needs $70 a barrel oil to meet its own fiscal needs there. So that's where they break even at $70. Russia, it's a much lower cost point. Russia only needs $40 barrel to break even for their fiscal needs. This is truly an effort to put U.S. frackers out of business, because our frackers aren't subject to any of the controls that the OPEC group tries to put on any of the oil producers. So this is an effort to drive them out of business. It'll be short term, so I don't know how long that takes, but it'll definitely put them out of business at this price, and they'll get it back up as quickly as they can, because oil capacity in terms of storage is at 100%. They have no place to put this oil, and they're talking about putting it up. It's going to be sitting on ships in the middle of the ocean because they have no storage tanks left to put it in. So when a time when the world is using less oil because the cruise ships aren't using it, the airlines aren't using it, the shippers aren't using it, this is truly to, as Drew said, let's put the competitors out of business, and I think it will work. So I think they're going to go under here.
Let's go to the next question. Thanks, guys.
Our next question comes from Vincent DeVita.
Hey, Vince. Good morning, or good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Just want to say what a great honor and pleasure to address the core of First Foundation's financial stewardship. I liked everything you guys said, but my concern is all of the elements that we've used in the past when we've had business downturns and all, such as tax cuts, government spending, Federal Reserve, those are elements we use to help in the normal business cycle that we've had for 100 years. As Rick pointed out, this is different in that we're scared. This virus is shutting the country down. And all these particular elements that we talk about that would fix the economy in the past, it's not going to work until, as Rick said, we start seeing less deaths, less people contracting the disease. And until that happens, this is going to be frantic yet. And for that reason, I'm wondering, why is the stock market open for traders who, somebody asks who's making money? Those who are shorting the market are making money.
Yeah.
Why don't we shut it down for a while? We shut it down during the day when it dropped 7%. It seems to me it's driving a lot of other people crazy. Other than worrying about the illness, we're worrying about our nest eggs and how much money we have.
Any comments? Like I say, these prices today do not reflect value. These prices reflect a cost of turning your stocks into cash, and that cost is extremely high right now, and that cost will dissipate. So I think, you know, I thought maybe the economy may be initially V-shaped, then I went to a U-shape in that it declines and struggles along the bottom and then recovers. And I think that's still the most likely scenario, is that because if you're a landlord and your restaurant goes out of business, you're not going to find a better restaurant to come in there. You're going to work with that person and get them back in. And I see that, you know, it seems to be pulling the country together. I noticed my wife called and we ordered, I think, eight St. Patrick's Day dinner from our favorite restaurant. And when my daughter went there, they had them lined up all down the counter that other people had done the same thing. So they weren't going in, but it was everybody trying to help the restaurateur out. And so I think we'll pull together through this. And I think that these prices are more temporary, because what was the outcome of 2008, a lot of companies with the wherewithal start buying their own stock because they're so cheap. And they just announced yesterday that the CEOs and workers, senior management, buying their own company stock was at an all-time high in the Russell 2000 index. So there are a lot of companies where the management teams feel that their stock is way undervalued and are taking a longer term view. So if we look out even 12 months, you know, by then we're going to have a vaccine. We're going to have, things back on track. And so we'll be talking about the recovery in 6 months, not how this thing's getting worse.
I think we have one last question, operator, and then we're going to conclude the call.
Sure. Your final question comes from the line of Thomas Luby.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Hey, John. How are you today?
Good.
I appreciate the forum that you guys created, and it's been very useful and very helpful in putting things in perspective. Drew helped me understand, you know, the level of volatility through technology that's grown over the last 10 years. However, I think I sent you an email from hedge manager Bass, Kyle Bass, about his take on it, and it seemed to be common wisdom at that time on March 9th, 9 days ago, that the worst case scenario was baked into the prices then. So my question is, if that were the case, well, first of all, is that true? Do you see it that way, number one? And number two, if that is the case, why are we still seeing this free fall?
I would say markets are pricing in the worst case scenario. It's not market valuations and fundamentals at this point. What everyone's really looking at is what are the number of cases that are growing for coronavirus on a daily basis. Which countries are able to sustain it, flatten out the curve, and more important, looking at the deaths. That is the unknown right now. Will Europe and will the United States follow China and South Korea, Singapore, and flattening the curve, or are they going to follow Italy and continue to allow those things to occur, the deaths and the infections? That's what the market is pricing in right now, is that we're not able to contain it, to be frank. I think PEs at this point, we're back to equity valuations of 2016. So think about that. We wiped out all the gains for the last 4 years when we've seen some really record, earnings from companies. We've seen tax breaks for corporate America, tax rates for Americans as a whole. All of that good stuff has been washed away rather quickly in 4 weeks. We don't think that's permanent. But valuations at this point, we're below 14 times forward earnings on the S&P 500. Historically, that number is about 15.5. So we're cheap, definitely cheap. We weren't excessive. And it just the market is trading on more irrationality.
And the only thing I'd add to that, Tom, is markets tend to overshoot on the upside and the downside. And all the stuff Drew said, I concur. I think the market's also been waiting for this fiscal stimulus to see if there's an urgency in Congress that they could get together and work something out. So that mark, the bottom in 08. So I think that might be the next domino here if they can put that in place, because, you know, obviously there's a lot of uncertainty around the virus. Nobody can come up with when is it going to start getting less worse. That's anybody's guess. And as Drew said, the market tends to price in the worst. So we might be close to the bottom. Maybe there's a fewer percentage, but it sure feels like we're pretty close to the bottom here. And I'm not sure what trigger or what signal is going to mark the bottom, whether it's the fiscal stimulus passage or something else. But it sure feels, in the years I've been doing this, I sure feel some of that pain right now that we're pretty close to the bottom. Rick, do you have anything to add before we conclude?
No, I think, you know, the old story in the market is it's darkest before dawn. And, you know, I think we're going to look back upon this as a real buying opportunity. These companies like Disney are going to outlive all of us. I would say Microsoft and others, you know, they're not going away, and their prices are on sale. And, you know, the stock market's the most difficult place to buy things on sale. You know, we would run to Nordstrom's if they had a sale, but, you know, people are more worried about holdings going lower rather than missing the opportunity to the upside. And that's human nature. But it is a tough time to hold in there. If you don't have to sell, this is not the time to sell. So anyway, but we're
thanks,
here for
Rick.
All of you. So we're here for everybody to call us. So.
Thanks, Rick. And thank you, everyone, for taking the time today. On behalf of Rick, Drew, and the entire team, I want to thank you. We will get through this. We will continue to communicate with you directly through your wealth advisor and through your through our thought leadership pieces, which can be found on the website. And then a recording of this call will be made available and posted to our website as soon as possible. Thank you, and stay healthy. And please call us if there's anything we can do. And again, thank you.
Thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may now disconnect your lines and have a wonderful day.